I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The House of Representatives is voting today to set up a select committee to investigate the attacks on the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi on September 11, 2012, which killed four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador. Republicans have charged a White House cover-up. Democrats have countered that it's a ploy to discredit Hillary Clinton as she weighs a run for the presidency. We asked Alex Seitz-Wald, political correspondent for National Journal, to walk us through the political debate over Benghazi, and he joins us from the Atlantic Media Studios. And Alex, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So the vote today is on setting up the select committee. What's the reasoning for the committee?
Well, we'll remember that Benghazi took place in September of 2012, so it's been going on for a while. There have been eight congressional committees in both the House and Senate that have looked into this, and the administration says they've complied and they've turned over thousands of pages of documents. But just last week, the conservative watchdog agency Judicial Watch, through a Freedom of Information request, got a new email that had never been seen before publicly from a White House national security advisor, which many on the right characterize as showing that the administration acted from a political rather than a national security point of view. When John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, saw this email, he decided that it was time to move ahead with the select committee because the email meant one of two things. Either that the existing committees had not been able to do their job properly because of incompetence or some for whatever reason, or that the administration was still holding things back and so they needed to continue to press forward. And he's been under pressure from conservatives in his own caucus for years now to set up a select committee, and so he decided to move ahead and do that and will appoint Trey Gowdy, a former federal prosecutor from South Carolina, to head that committee.
Is there any reason to think that the White House had withheld this information? Had there been subpoenas for this particular email or emails from the White House?
Well, the White House has been subpoenaed several times, and they said that they did not release this email because the existing subpoenas didn't pertain to Ben Rhodes, the White House official who sent the email. So, I think they deserve a little bit of blame here for setting up a controversy that they're now calling a circus. They took a kind of narrow view. They tried to win the news cycle from a political point of view instead of looking down the road. And I think if they had released this email in the initial investigation and they had been more forthcoming, then they wouldn't have this problem because it wouldn't be coming out, somewhat so far away from the actual attack.
But it seems that the debate is not about why the embassy was so vulnerable on this day, of course, the anniversary of September 11th, but how the White House handled that and how Susan Rice talked about it when she was interviewed on all those talk shows on the Sunday after the attack.
Right, and that's exactly what this email from Ben Rhodes pertained to. So there's sort of two issues here that Republicans have with the administration. One is the preparation for the attack, and they sort of haven't really found much that they can go on there. The other, which they've focused on, is the talking points that Susan Rice used on the Sunday shows. And they argue that, this was in the middle of an election year, just before President Obama was up for – just before voters were going to go to the polls to decide if President Obama would win again. So they charge that the administration removed the use of terror or any kind of references to al-Qaeda for political reasons. And this email that came out so far, 2 years after the attack and after those talking points, seems to suggest that that might be true, to at least to a small degree. So they say there's so much more here. And, even if the administration has nothing to hide, they've been withholding evidence. And so they feel that they need to move ahead and bring whatever else remains into the light.
Now, this gets a bit into the weeds, but what Rhodes said in that email to underscore that these protests are rooted in an internet video and not a broader failure of policy. And again, these are the weeds, but nonetheless, it seems like the debate is about the weeds, whether the attack on the embassy was based on this horrifying video that denigrated Muhammad, or whether it was a more spontaneous attack on the embassy, or whether it was organized by some terrorist group.
Right. And we have to remember, and I think we often forget when we look back, that at the time of the attack on September 11th, there were violent protests all across the Middle East. There were protesters scaling the walls of the embassy in Cairo. Several other embassies had been under attack from protests sparked by this video. So when the attack at Benghazi happened. Initially, many thought that it was similar to these other protests and just kind of got out of control. We learned pretty quickly afterwards that that wasn't the case and there was no protest. So the Republicans have focused on this, saying that, you know, it would have undercut Obama's message that he had killed bin Laden and he had put al-Qaeda on defense. It would have undermined his message so much to have acknowledged that the Benghazi attack was terrorist attack that they suppressed that evidence. It shows, you know, how far we've gotten away from the actual attack, though, that this is
exactly
what we're arguing about now.
Well, and even what Susan Rice said on those various talk shows, she talked about extremist elements. She talked about the protests. She talked about the video. She used the word spontaneous. I mean, it seemed that she covered a lot of various scenarios in those interviews.
Right. And you know, remember, she was the UN ambassador. She was not Secretary of State. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was initially invited, and the administration turned that down. And there were several other administration officials who did refer to terror, or they used the word terror. So, you know, I think what's going on here, and everyone seems to agree, we've had many investigations, as I said, 8 congressional committees. Right. There was an administration review. And there's some wrongdoing at lower levels. But once the GOP got a hold of this issue, they saw an opportunity for political gain to attack both Obama and Secretary Clinton if she decides to run in 2016. And they're not going to let it go, mostly for political reason.
Well, and just picking up, I went to a timeline because I just wanted to sort of look at who said what when. And on September 12th, the president was in the Rose Garden. He said, "No act of terror will ever shake the resolve of this great nation." A couple of days later, he was actually stumping out in Colorado, "To those who will do us harm, no act of terror will go unpunished." So it's interesting to me that the president was using the word terror, even if Susan Rice didn't on that Sunday morning.
Right. And Mitt Romney, in a debate just before the election, got in trouble when he accused the president of not calling it a terror attack. And the moderator, CNN's Candy Crowley, corrected him and said, actually, it was. And that's sort of that little moment is sort of a microcosm of the larger fears of Republican overreach here, that they might go too strong against the administration, get ahead of the facts, as they have several times. For example, Daryl Issa, the chief Republican on the Oversight Committee, which had, until the Select Committee, been in charge of the Benghazi investigation, he said that Hillary Clinton issued a stand-down order to U.S. troops to come and save the diplomats in Benghazi, and that's absolutely not true. Mm. So they need to be, you know, they balance this desire to both go after the administration and not look foolish in being overly partisan.
But is this a linguistic debate? Is that what we're talking about? Using the word terror attack, for instance?
On some level, absolutely. It's a semantic, it's a linguistic debate. But it's wrapped up in so much more. I mean, it's really conflicting worldviews about what the U.S. should – what the role the U.S. should play in the world. Should it be a more muscular force tracking down terrorists around the world, or should it be, you know, stay closer to home? And so I think what the real thing that they're trying to get at here is a lack of foreign policy muscularism. You know, the Obama administration has had the death of bin Laden as a sort of feather in their cap on national security, and this cuts right at that. It undermines their work in Libya, which Secretary of Clinton led, and it undermines her work, her entire term in Secretary of State, by putting sort of an asterisk on the legacies. They can always point to, there were 4 dead Americans on your watch. So I think that's, you know, it's on one hand it's linguistic, but it's so much more at the same time.
You know, I was always curious why it was Susan Rice and not Hillary Clinton who appeared on all those talk shows on Sunday. After all, she was the Secretary of State.
Yeah, and I think this will go down as a horrible career move for Ambassador Rice. Secretary Clinton was initially asked. She declined, and because of she has a sort of special – or had a sort of special relationship with the Obama White House given their history, they let her decline and they didn't push it too hard. Mm. So – they also asked for Secretary of Defense, and he declined as well. So Susan Rice sort of, as a team player, took the job, even though she had nothing to do, you know, with the Benghazi attack. She was not on overseeing any of the response to it. This was really sort of not her wheelhouse, and yet she took it on. And because she took it on, she was Obama's first choice to replace Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. But because of the controversy around these talking points, her nomination was scuttled, and now John Kerry is Secretary of State.
Tell us about this Representative Trey Gowdy, who will be, I guess, heading up this special committee.
Well, I think his background really tells you a lot about where Republicans are going on this and what they're thinking. He's a former federal prosecutor who apparently never lost a case, very aggressive. He ran as when he ran for Congress, he ran on his record as a prosecutor and for how aggressive he was. And he's even talked about this in terms of a trial. He's referred to the administration as the defense and him as the prosecutor, which kind of belies the notion that this is a serious investigation. You know, if you've already determined that you think one side is guilty, as a prosecutor would go into a trial, then it's not really a serious investigation where you're trying to determine the facts. It's more of an antagonistic kind of approach that he's, you know, looking to make show that the administration is guilty in the eyes of the jury, in this case, the public.
Well, and I wonder whether the National Republican Congressional Committee has stepped on his toes, because he said this is not a chance to raise money, and the committee has set up a website. You can become a Benghazi watchdog right now. House Republicans will make sure that no one will get away from Gowdy and the Select Committee. This is going to be a national effort for a national investigation, basically using this to raise money.
Yeah, and they're not alone. I mean, the National Republican Senatorial Committee, their counterpart in the Senate, has also used Benghazi and email solicitations. A whole host of outside conservative groups, Tea Party groups, have used Benghazi. I've gotten emails from one Tea Party group, somebody who has the pseudonym, I assume, of Benjamin Ghazi. Oh. But it just goes to show how much they have made this front and center. You know, it fits into a notion that appeals to the conservative base, that the administration is corrupt, that the administration is lying to you, is hiding, is, you know, doesn't care about the deaths of four Americans. So Gowdy has to distance himself from that on one hand. But on the other hand, everything that he does and anything that he can do to embarrass the administration will help conservatives raise money heading into the election.
And we're almost up in a break here, but does this sort of parallel what's going on with the IRS investigations?
Absolutely. And just yesterday, the House held Lois Lerner, former IRS official at the center of the IRS controversy, in contempt. I think, you know, there's not that Congress was doing very much anyway, but heading into the election, there's even less legislating that's going to happen. And the Republican majority is focused almost entirely on oversight, which might be a nice word, a euphemism for, you know, going after the administration.
And it's all about November 2014?
All about November 2014 and November 2016. And I think that you can really see a turn, excuse me, about a year and a half ago, when the Benghazi investigations and Daryl Issa, who I mentioned, were fairly complimentary to Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State at the time, and were focused mostly on Obama because, of course, he was the one who was up for re-election. Now they've turned and they've put a lot of pressure on Clinton with an eye to 2016.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Alex Seitz-Wald, political correspondent for National Journal. And again, we invited him to join us on Radio Times and walk us through the political debate over Benghazi. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The National Museum of American Jewish History at 5th and Market supports WHYY and presents Jackie Robinson, Outsider Hero, on Thursday, May 8th at 7. Inspired by the legacy of the legendary barrier-breaking 42, the official historian of Major League Baseball, John Thorne, will lead a conversation on the contemporary relevance of Robinson's legacy for outsiders of every kind. Held in conjunction with the special exhibition Chasing Dreams, Baseball and Becoming American, currently on view. NMAJH.org or 215-923-3811.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps make nonprofits stronger, offering workshops and services designed to increase effectiveness and build the capacity of organizations throughout southeastern Pennsylvania. The Philadelphia Foundation can help you support the organizations you care about today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417, or online at philafound.org.
International House Philadelphia supports WHYY. International House channels the rhythms of Brazilian Carnival at its 53rd Global Gala, The Colors of Brazil, Saturday, May 17th. This black tie benefit features a sit-down dinner with an authentic Brazilian menu, a silent auction, a live performance by Dendian Band, and more. For tickets, ihousephilly.org/globalgala or 215-387-5125. International House Philadelphia, the hub of international culture.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about yet another investigation into the handling of the Benghazi attack by the Obama administration. The GOP House leadership has called for a special committee. And joining us is Alex Seitz-Wald, political correspondent for National Journal. And again, any questions or comments, the phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Alex, I'm thinking about the testimony that Hillary Clinton gave, I think it was January 2013, before a congressional committee where she, really lost her temper at the people that were questioning her. It seems she's ready to take somebody on this issue, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. And that moment is really crucial. It's she's being asked about the talking points, and she kind of just loses her temper in a moment of frustration, and she says, "What difference does it make at this point? You know, what there are more important things to do." And at the time, initially, her staff thought that that was a good move for her. They thought that she was, you know, turning the tables on Republicans for politicizing this event, and they thought that she would come out looking good. That's according to a new book about her time as Secretary of State. But in truth, what happened is it turned around, and that clip has now become just crucial to the zeitgeist, the conservative zeitgeist around Benghazi, and it's the one thing that people always point to when they talk about Hillary Clinton and Benghazi on the right.
Basically saying, what difference does it make? I mean, is that the sort of the phrase that's being used against her?
Well, she was talking about the talking points, but in the conservative retelling, as it's entered the conservative imagination, the what difference does it make refers to the deaths, the four right. dead Americans. Right. And so they're painting her as cold, heartless, maybe even, and this is sort of the fringiest version of the conspiracy theory, but maybe even that she wanted these Americans dead or she didn't Whoa. Care that the Americans Whoa. Died. So this clip is a touchstone for them that touches on this whole well of just negative feeling about Clinton. That it's a preconceived notion that they just sort of know intuitively to be true, even though there's no evidence to support it.
Now, where does that leave the current Secretary of State, John Kerry?
Well, it leaves him in a tricky situation. He was in the Senate at the time. He, was in no oversight capacity, but he has been he's been subpoenaed, in fact, by the Oversight Committee, not the Select Committee, but the Oversight Committee, to testify about Benghazi and about sort of the State Department's, the alleged State Department's cover up and refusal to give documents to Congress. What's interesting is Daryl Issa, when he sent that subpoena, he hadn't even invited the secretary to come speak. He hadn't looked at the secretary's schedule. He just kind of fired it off, and it turns out the day that he asked him to speak, Secretary Kerry was already scheduled to be in Mexico. So and sort of another instance of the desire to score political points getting ahead of the actual desire to find something out.
Is there any way to know what the public thinks or even cares about what Congress is doing about Benghazi? Obviously a tragedy when four Americans are killed.
Well, it's interesting. Often these kinds of Washington scandals don't really permeate the minds of most voters. But it's been going on long enough, and it was fairly central towards the end of the 2012 presidential campaign. And if you look at the polls, a surprising number, I mean, some 90%, over 90% in some polls of Americans are aware of Benghazi, which is, really remarkable for something like this. And another interesting piece of data point from the polls, when Pew asked people what they thought Hillary Clinton's biggest weakness was heading into 2016, and they didn't provide them with a list, they just asked them to name something off the top of their head, the number one response from both Republicans and Democrats was Benghazi. So it's clearly broken through. It's definitely, you know, whether Americans have strong feelings one way or another about it, they are aware of it. And I think that's a danger for Clinton. If it's the first thing that people think of when they think of her term as Secretary of State, that could be a real danger to her. And I think a lot of Democrats have dismissed this. They say that this, you know, these attacks are unfair, that they're conspiracy theories. And even if they're right, I think they're doing themselves a disservice by not acknowledging how much power this controversy has.
But do you think that there's something that the White House could do to essentially put this issue to rest?
At this point, no, absolutely not. The cat is out of the bag. They are never going to get this under control. They're just going to have to manage it, you know, day to day. I think they missed an opportunity. You know, the old adage, the cover up is worse than the crime. It's not that the White House covered up any kind of wrongdoing. At least we haven't seen any evidence of that. But rather, they were withholding. They did not provide as much information as they could have on many occasions, which is an understandable response to a very aggressive and partisan investigation. But on the other hand, when a new email that has never been seen despite, you know, 8 congressional committees, 25,000 pages of documents, when a new email comes out 2 years later, that's something that they could have avoided by just putting everything on the table early on and, you know, opening the book saying, this is what happened, we messed up, let's move on. And because they didn't do that, it's still alive today.
But is that what passes for a smoking gun then? I mean, I've looked at the email, and obviously he's Rhodes is telling Susan Rice sort of how to frame this issue. But, you know, it's not much more than that, is it?
I would say it's absolutely not. But for the base, for the conservative base, and that's really, I should say, that's really the audience here for a lot of the conservative investigations. I don't think they expect to win over independents per se, but they see this as an opportunity to rile up the base, and it absolutely has. I wrote a story the other day where I looked at some social media analytics, and people tweet about Benghazi every 12 seconds.
Right.
So, you know, I this email, while it might not convince somebody who, you know, is taking a holistic approach to the evidence, if you're primed to believe that the White House is lying to you, that the White House is covering things up, you see this email and it just confirms all of those preconceived suspicions.
Well, Alex Seitzwald, thank you very much for getting us up to speed on what's going on in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he's a political correspondent for a national journal and joined us from the Atlantic Media Studio. Well, back in mid-April, several hundred Nigerian schoolgirls were kidnapped by a militant Islamic group, Boko Haram, whose name roughly translated means Western education is sinful. In a recently released video, the leader of the group called the girls slaves and said, "I will sell them in the marketplace by Allah." This is not the first time this terrorist group has targeted children in this country. There have been large protests in Nigeria complaining about inaction and incompetence by the government of President Goodluck Jonathan. The Obama administration is sending in advisors to assist his government, which has also been accused of violent attacks on the civilian population. We asked Bronwyn Bruton to join us on Radio Times, Deputy Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, to our listeners, obviously we're shifting gears here. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. This is an issue that we obviously have been had a lot of questions about and I think has consumed a lot of international attention as well. So if you want to join our conversation, do give us a call. Brahman, why would an organization, a terrorist organization, we're talking here about Boko Haram, why do they target children? Because we know that they have killed, even burned young boys who are attending school.
They have indeed. And, you know, it's a great question and a complicated one. And the first thing I'd like to say is I don't think a terrorist organization would do that. When we talk about a terrorist organization, typically you're talking about a radical Islamist jihadist group like Al-Qaeda. And when groups like that use violence, they do it very carefully.
Wow.
They want to make a political point, and they choose their targets with great care. When you're talking about Boko Haram, it is very frequently described as a terrorist organization, but it's really an African rebel group. it's far, far more in the mold of the Lord's Resistance Army in northern Uganda, which is headed by the infamous Joseph Kony. You'll remember the Invisible Children video that made a huge stir in this country as well. Boko Haram is much more like the LRA. They do have a religious agenda, or I should say, they do attempt to use the Quran, the Muslim holy book, to justify what they do. But that's about as far as you can take it in terms of their ideology. They target school children not only because they object, they say, on religious grounds to Western education, but because Western education is a status symbol in northern Nigeria. The place is very, very poor. Typically, it's only the children of rich people who are able to go to Western schools. It opens doors for them later to go into the government and to become, again, in Boko Haram's view, to become oppressors of the population. It's connected to colonial complaints. It's connected to sort of a Robin Hood complex that Boko Haram seems to have. So it's a very complicated quasi-political, quasi-religious complaint.
Well, go ahead.
Rock bottom. It's also, I think, it's also possible to sort of overthink why they're doing things, because Boko Haram is an undisciplined group that's mostly really young guys with guns. And at some level, when they do horrible things, they're doing them because they can't.
Well, it's interesting that you make a distinction between terrorist groups and this rebel group, as you describe it. There was a piece in the New York Times today, I think, about how Al-Qaeda is really distancing themselves, or what's left of Al-Qaeda, distancing themselves from this group, basically underscoring exactly what you said.
Yeah, I was quoted in the New York Times article.
Yes, you were.
Actually.
I saw that.
And the point that I tried to make was that if you look at Al-Qaeda, they've done things like complain about the fact that the United States has occasionally killed children in drone strikes, not intentionally, by accident. And they've made this to be a very, very great crime that the United States has committed. And if you're an organization who's using that as a moral platform, it's really hard to have an affiliate that is slaughtering school children indiscriminately and treating them as sex slaves, particularly if they're Muslim school children. So you can see sort of the public relations problem that it poses.
What do you think is the fate of these girls? Obviously, we don't know exactly where they are. We have this leader saying, calling them slaves, telling them that he's gonna sell them. But what, assuming they don't get rescued or whatever happens, what do you think their fate could be?
Well, the kidnapping of girls is not at all an unusual tactic among African rebel groups. The LRA did it very commonly. Groups in the Democratic Republic of Congo do it commonly. Typically, the girls, if they're not sold, as Chacal, the leader, has threatened to do, they're often given to fighters or commanders within the rebel group, and they're forced to act essentially as, they call them wives. They're asked to carry things, to do the cooking, to do the cleaning. They bear the soldiers' children. Mm. They're basically kept in sort of a forced captivity for very, very long periods of time.
This is largely, I guess, happening when we talk about Boko Haram. It's the northern part of Nigeria, yes?
The northern part of Nigeria, which is very, very poor. Nigeria is an incredibly diverse country. It's kind of like the United States in the sense that you have big cities like Abuja and Lagos, which are kind of like Washington, D.C. and New York City in terms of being political and commercial capitals. And then you have the north, and the north is kind of like the very backwaters of say, Alabama. It's a completely different culture, and it's really devoid of many of the development benefits and commercial benefits that are available in the south.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Bronwyn Bruton. She's a deputy director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. And we called her up because we wanted to talk about the girls that were kidnapped last month, Nigerian schoolgirls kidnapped by this group called Boko Haram. And it's a chance to talk about this part of the world and what's been happening in Nigeria. I should add that President Obama is sending in advisors to assist the government, which has been accused of violent attacks on the civilian population as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Brumman, if you could talk a bit about the government, which seems to have, if I can say, blood on its hands as well.
It's really an enormous problem, yes. The Nigerian government has responded very forcefully to the Boko Haram insurgency in the north. They've sent up thousands of troops over the past several years. They've declared a state of emergency up there in the north a year ago. And during that time, they are accused of killing thousands of civilians. They've been accused of burning a village to the ground because they suspected that it was harboring members of Boko Haram. And it is not unusual for them to hear a report that Boko Haram fighters are in a village, go into the village, gather up all the young Muslim men that they can find, and summarily execute large numbers of them. And the accusations are that they'll do horrible things like cram over 100 people into a very small cell, interrogate someone, shoot them in the leg, throw them back in the cell, and leave them to bleed to death amongst all the other detainees. So we're talking about really, really horrible crimes as well being committed by the Nigerian military to such a large extent that many members of the population actually are unsure about whether Boko Haram or the Nigerian military is the biggest threat that they're facing.
I mean, we're talking about human rights abuses here.
Yeah, it's bad on both sides. And that really poses a problem for the U.S., which I think, you know, Washington would like to intervene. There's a lot of pressure on President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry to do something about this crisis. But we have laws in the United States that prevent the American military from giving assistance to militaries that are perpetrating human rights abuses. So it really ties our hands.
And that's the Leahy Amendment, right?
That's right.
And what does that amendment say?
The Leahy Amendment basically says that neither the State Department nor the Defense Department are permitted to provide assistance, and particularly that means training, and weapons and operational supplies to any foreign military units that are suspected or known to have committed human rights abuses. And so if you're an American commander and you want to go and help some of the troops up in northern Nigeria, you're actually required to do an investigation and to certify that the troops you are going to help, the individual unit that you are going to help, has clean hands.
How would you know that?
Well, it's really hard. It's very hard in the case of Nigeria because record keeping is not particularly good, and troops get rotated in and out from different parts of the country, so it's difficult to tell who's been where. You have to make the assumption in the northern Nigerian context, because the human rights abuses have been so extensive, that just about all the regiments up there are at least worthy of suspicion, if you're not going to assume outright that they have perpetrated abuses. So in the northern Nigerian context, it is very, very hard indeed.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Bronwyn Bruton, Deputy Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. And we asked her to join us in this portion of Radio Times to talk about Nigeria, to talk about the rebel group, as she calls it, Boko Haram, and the fact that last month several hundred Nigerian schoolgirls were kidnapped. Their whereabouts is unknown at this point. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia supports WHYY. CTCA now offers genomic testing to help doctors determine treatment options based on patients' personal genetic makeup. Genomic tumor assessment may hold the key to help patients improve quality of life and discover more precise treatment options that were previously not considered. More at cancercenter.com. Cancer Treatment Centers of America. Care that never quits.
supporting WHYY, Simpson Meadows, a retirement community in Downingtown, PA, in Chester County. Managed by Simpson Senior Services, a nonprofit with a long-standing tradition of care. Simpson Meadows provides personal care for senior adults, along with memory care, respite, and independent living. A specially designed personal care neighborhood staffed with licensed nurses provides assistance with daily tasks to help residents remain as independent as possible. More at simpsonmeadows.org.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we have been catching up on two stories in this hour. Radio Times began with a discussion about another investigation into the Benghazi attacks, and now we're shifting our attention. We're talking about Nigeria, the kidnapping of schoolgirls by a group known as Boko Haram, a horrifying story that has gotten worldwide attention. And Bronwyn Bruton from the Atlantic Council is our guest. Any questions or comments, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at whyy. Radio Times. Bronwyn, I'm just curious about then what you think the Obama administration can do. It is sending in advisors. I'm wondering about drone intelligence or the kind of intelligence that this government has sort of been known to get from other parts of the world. Can that be applied in a place like Nigeria?
Well, it could be. The advisors who are being sent in, as far as I understand, are being sent to Abuja, which is the capital. That is 500 miles away from Maiduguri, where Boko Haram has its epicenter. So we do need to understand that when we're talking about military advisors being sent, they're not going to where the girls were kidnapped, and that's obviously going to limit their effectiveness somewhat. Drone surveillance and intelligence sharing is definitely an option, although officials in the Obama administration have indicated that in the past, Goodluck Jonathan, the president of Nigeria's administration, hasn't been very receptive to American advice or intelligence tips. So whether that would be useful, I think it might depend somewhat on a change of heart by the Nigerian government, too.
Yes. You have made some interesting parallels to the Lord's Resistance Army, headed up by Joseph Kony in Uganda. The U.S. had sent in some military advisors to try to find him. They haven't found him either. And I'm just curious about why you think that is and why it's so difficult to find people. I know it's a big continent and big countries there as well.
Sure. Well, in the case of the Lord's Resistance Army, formerly they were based in northern Nigeria, but they're now jumping around several different countries, including southern Sudan, the Central African Republic, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, all of which are war zones. And they're deeply forested. We're talking about heavy jungles where drone surveillance, for example, can be not very effective. One of the major problems in the hunt for Joseph Kony has been for a long time that the Ugandan army doesn't have very good relations with the neighboring countries. And CAR and DRC don't really necessarily want Ugandan troops storming over their borders to try to catch Joseph Kony and his LRA. That same situation applies in northern Nigeria with Boko Haram. Cameroon, for example, doesn't really want to see Nigerian troops who are accused of human rights violations storming over its borders and potentially injuring its own citizens. U.S. intervention in the LRA case has been really helpful to try to mend some of those diplomatic problems. And U.S. intervention in the northern Nigeria case could have the same effect, hopefully, if the U.S. makes it clear to neighboring countries that Boko Haram is an international scourge, and this is an international hunt to end the problem, they could be a lot more receptive to foreign troops coming in and helping to defeat Boko Haram fighters as they try to escape. So that's one thing the U.S. could do that would be super useful.
You have described the abuses, even atrocities, by the government of Nigeria and also Boko Haram. So we're talking about civilians caught between these two forces?
Very much so. Yeah, absolutely. The Nigerian government has actually complained about the unwillingness of parents, for example, to share information with them in the search for the girls. And while on the one hand, it's not appropriate to put that blame back on the parents, clearly, there's a couple of different things going on there. One of them, obviously, is the deep fear of reprisals by Boko Haram. If the parents help the government, you know, Boko Haram has done terrible things to people they consider informants. But it's also partially the fear that if some villager has seen one of the girls or seen a convoy of girls and has some information to report and they call in and say, hey, these people are in or near our village, there's a possibility that they're going to bring a rampaging group of soldiers down on their village. And we've talked about the consequences that that can bring. So it's really hard. The human rights abuses have prevented the Nigerian army from getting the kind of tips that they really need from the local population in order to solve this kidnapping.
Do you think there's anything the U.S. government can do to put pressure on the government of Goodluck Jonathan to address and clean up some of this activity?
I have no doubt whatsoever that Washington will try very hard. But I'm honestly more encouraged by the fact that the Twitterverse and so many world citizens are calling attention to this. I think that Jonathan's advisors and the president himself are completely flabbergasted to find themselves at the epicenter of so much international outrage. And I'm hoping it'll have an effect.
Well, and I'm thinking of the protests that we're seeing in Nigeria as well.
Absolutely. And not only in Nigeria, but in London and New York. Mm-hmm. It really is becoming a global phenomenon. And I really am hopeful that that will have an impact.
And why do you think it's something about girls being kidnapped that galvanize worldwide attention?
Well, possibly. I mean, it was a bizarre thing. I mean, the girls were kidnapped more than 3 weeks ago.
Right.
And it took quite a long time for attention to be drawn to their plight. The murder of 59 schoolboys back in July of 2013, Boko Haram went into a school and burned the school down. 59 boys were killed. The ones who tried to avoid burning in their beds were hacked to death on the lawn with machetes. A completely horrifying incident,
yes.
But it didn't cause a ripple in the international press. So I do wonder if the luridness of Shekau's statements about the girls being slaves and selling them and Allah having told him to sell them on the marketplace, it isn't part of the outrage here.
And again, we're talking with Bronwyn Bruton. She's a deputy director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. And again, we called her up because we wanted to talk about what's been going on in Nigeria, this group Boko Haram, and also the government of Goodluck Jonathan, and the fact that the world is paying attention to what happened to these girls. And of course, that raises a whole host of questions about what has been going on in Nigeria. And we want to give you a chance to join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And Bronwyn, I think for a lot of people, I would include myself as well, when you hear about something like this, you feel like, you know, what can I do? What can Americans do to address this issue and address some of the systemic problems that we've been talking about?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I wish that there were an easy answer. But I would say, you know, from my vantage point, as someone who's followed the workings of Boko Haram and the Nigerian government for a long time, I think that the attention that this issue is getting is useful. It's genuinely a useful thing. It's causing the Nigerian government to reflect on its tactics in an urgent way. And that means a lot.
Right.
I'm concerned about the probability of finding the girls at this stage. It has been more than 3 weeks since they were kidnapped at this point, and the State Department has indicated its fears that the girls have already been sold over the border into neighboring countries. And it's very likely that they've been scattered as well. So my hope would be that at least some of them would be recovered, but I think the idea of a large-scale rescue mission at this stage doesn't strike me as very feasible. But Americans do need to remember, I think, that Boko Haram is not like the LRA, which sort of hit its peak 10 years ago. Boko Haram is a threat that's getting worse and worse every single day. And since the girls were kidnapped, for example, Boko Haram has attacked a village and allegedly killed 300 more people.
Yeah, I was reading about that earlier this week, right?
That's right, just a couple of days ago. And just before that, they attacked a different village, and they went door to door, and they allegedly, again, kidnapped 8 or 12 other girls who were also between the ages of 12 and 15. They just snatched them right out of their homes. So this is not a problem that's just restricted to those girls who were stolen. They are an ongoing threat.
And do they want their own country? Is that when you think about what they want, what do you think that is?
One of the real problems with Boko Haram is that, like the LRA, their political objectives are not terribly coherent and they're not very logical. What Boko Haram says that it wants broadly is to implement the Sharia law, which is the Islamic law, across all of Nigeria, which is half Christian and half Muslim.
Right.
Failing that, they would like to have a stricter version of Sharia implemented in the north. And the only really concrete immediate demand that they have is the release of their own fighters who have been captured over the years. But, you know, there's not really a person in Boko Haram, including that leader whose video has made such a stir, who really represents the group and is in a position to negotiate for them. It's a highly disorganized, highly fractious, difficult group to get a handle on.
Could you also call it a cult?
I would call it a cult, absolutely. I don't think anyone who's seen Shekau's video, his incoherent rambling, in which he alleges that Allah is talking to him personally, could imagine that this was a person who has a scholarly understanding of Islam.
Indeed.
He comes across as being, quite crazy, to be honest.
Do you see this also in terms of a religious conflict between Christians and Muslims in Nigeria?
There have definitely been Christian-Muslim conflicts in the northern parts of Nigeria because of a perception that that Christian communities have access to more resources, particularly because the south is heavily Christian, than the northern Muslim communities do. But in most of Nigeria, Christians and Muslims coexist in perfect harmony. Lagos, the capital city, is just a complete melting pot where Muslims and Christians have gotten along effortlessly for many, many, many decades. Yes, there is a Muslim-Christian dynamic. We also need to remember that Boko Haram has been striking at Muslims as well. They kill Muslims constantly. And that's because they're not good enough Muslims for Boko Haram. So it's not just a Muslim-Christian thing.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. There's also the World Economic Forum on Africa about to take place in Nigeria.
That's right, absolutely. So this is a time that is very important to the Nigerian government. Nigeria wants to be seen as an economic success story in Africa. And much to its chagrin, I think the State Department has just issued a travel advisory for Lagos, warning Americans that it's not safe to go there and that the American embassy doesn't have the capacity to help them if they get hurt while traveling in the country. So it really casts a pall not only on Nigeria's reputation as an army, but on its economic ambitions, too.
And this is a country just awash with oil.
Yeah, Nigeria is one of, it's Africa's largest oil producer at this point, and the United States gets about 6% of its oil from Nigeria. So it is a major oil producer, although, we talk about the resource curse, and in the case of Nigeria, unfortunately, oil wealth, hasn't translated to prosperity for the average man.
Do you worry that when we talk about Africa, countries in Africa, and here we are talking about Nigeria, that it's always about a crisis, about human rights violations, about government corruption.
It's an unfortunate narrative, yes, because, you know, the reality in Africa is that there are some countries that are caught in that cycle of violence, but there are many others that are really succeeding, that are leaping over the sort of the poverty level and joining the middle class communities of the world. And they're becoming important consumer markets, and the term is they're really rising. The Africa rising narrative you'll have heard referred to many times. So it's a tale of two extremes.
And just to end on a more positive note than we certainly began on. So those rising countries in Africa are whom?
Botswana, for example, down in the south, Gabon, Brighton, very, very close to Nigeria, Tanzania, Kenya, although it certainly had its issues in recent years, is really doing great things with its economy. There's a whole host of them. Many of them are small. The great giants like Nigeria and the Democratic Republic of Congo and Sudan, for example, remain mired in conflict. But the pockets of real success are definitely there.
And do you think in the just couple of seconds that we have left, do you think Nigeria can not just address what we've been talking about, but also become a less corrupt government?
Well, that's everyone's very, very sincere hope. Elections are coming up very soon in 2015, and I think that will really be an indication of Nigeria's prospects. If they're free and fair, and if people are satisfied with the outcome, and if we can get an administration that is really committed to reform, Nigeria's prospects are good. But if there's another failed election, or if people feel that the results are unfair and that the government doesn't take the efforts to change that people are really starting to demand, then I think the prognosis is very bleak.
Well, Bronwyn Brewton, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. She's Deputy Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.